Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies and High Holiday Boot Camp. It's great to have everybody. So listen, some people think, you know, Rosh Hashanah, we're done, Yom Kippur, we just closed it out. It's time to take it easy. No, we have another half month that is filled chock full with holidays. And according to our tradition, just the way it's celebrated, so the first half of the month of Tishrei that we're in is solemn, days of awe, kind of days of seriousness. Now, of course, Chabad, we try to infuse the joy in everything, but overall, it's more solemn days. Whereas the second half of the month, beginning with the upcoming holiday of Sukkot and running into Shemini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, these are days of, these are the best, and days of joy. These are not days of awe, these are days of profound joy and ecstasy. And so we're meant to have, to wear many different hats. We wear the serious hat, we wear the party hat, we wear the joy hat, we wear the introspection hat, and it's not a contradiction, it's all part of a full-bodied, if you will, like a full
spectrum,
Boutique. What is that? Yeah, smorgasbord. Smorgasbord. How do you? What is the smorg? How does it end? Do we know? Board with a D, right? D or G?
Board
with a D. Smorgasbord. Not Borg.
Variant of an unkosher animal.
Right. Okay. So smorgasbord of activity. So Sunday night, there's no wet rest for the weary here, because last night we closed out Yom Kippur. Today is like just catching up and, you know, catching up on food and drink and hydration, which is very good, and building a sukkah. And then tomorrow's Erev Shabbos, so you're already shopping and cooking for Shabbos, and then Shabbos is Shabbos, and then Sunday is Erev Yom Tov. So you're already doing last-minute preparations for the holiday, which starts Sunday night. And of course, at Chabad of Town, how we roll in town is we have a party first night. Everyone's invited. Everyone's invited. Schusterman's house from 7 p.m. till midnight plus. Come by. Live sushi. When I said live sushi. No, that's exactly what I didn't mean. Uh-huh. By the way, how do you know when you're fishing which is the gefilte fish?
It's the one with the orange stripe down its back.
With the carrot on its back. Yes, exactly. And it's also in a big lake of gel. Oh, man, which makes fishing so easy because you just take the jar and you scoop. They're not going anywhere. Nowhere.
This is Jewish fishing.
This is Jewish. That's such Jewish fishing. It's like, I have no time. You think I'm waking up 5 o'clock in the morning? Are you kidding me? I'm going out 3 p.m. after I just got my day started, and I'm going to take my jar and scoop up and just can it, and we're done. Or we can go to the store and do the same thing. But I digress. We always digress. But getting back to the point. There's no time, in a good way, right? Yom Kippur, we have one day, Erev Shabbos, Erev Yom Tov, Yom Tov. Oh, first night, getting back. So everyone's invited, Shusterman's house, even those on Facebook Live. Come to Atlanta. It's going to be a party. Right on St. Charles, sushi, live rolling sushi, and just an opportunity to say blessings in the sukkah and say l'chaim to each other and wish each other blessings. It's a beautiful, beautiful experience. So we're running straight into the holiday of Sukkot. And there are two major mitzvot when it comes to this holiday. Number one is in the parking lot. You noticed it?
Yes.
In the back, there's a sukkah. Sukkot is plural, many huts. Sukkah is the singular. So we have our sukkah here on the Beltline or adjacent to the Beltline. And that's one mitzvah. The second mitzvah, which begins, now that mitzvah begins the night of Sukkot, Sunday night, which is why first opportunity we want to do a mitzvah and eat in the sukkah, hence the party. The first time you can do the second mitzvah, which we'll speak about in a moment, is the daytime, Monday morning, from daybreak on. When the morning begins, we have a second mitzvah. And the mitzvah is to take what's called the arba minim, the four types of plants. And we have here, this is the, what is this? What is it? The lulav, good. What's the lulav in English?
Palm.
Palm, exactly. Yes. We also have the, I'm not opening this up because somebody will use this for the holiday. This is a, can you see what this is?
Willow.
Willow. This is a willow, not a weeping willow. Weeping willow, is somebody at the door?
No.
Not for us, okay. The weeping willow is bent over. You ever see a weeping willow grow? It's like very sad. It's weeping.
We don't weep.
No, not in this holiday. Are you kidding me? The Arava, this is called Arava. Arava tree grows. These guys are pointing straight up to the heavens. How do I know this? We used to have an Arava tree in our backyard. Growing up in Pittsburgh, we had an Arava tree. Yeah, legit.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. Legit. And it had so many Aravas. Are you kidding me? Everyone came to us to cut down Aravas. It was great. Huh?
I have an Esrog tree.
You have an Esrog tree? Yeah. You told me that. How are they doing?
I haven't seen them for a while. So.
All right. Let us know. Have some pictures taken. Okay, so we have this Arava. We have the, check these out. If you thought those were cool, check out these. Yes? What is this? Myrtle. The myrtle.
Okay.
Yeah, Myrtle Beach, right. This is the Hadas. And finally, we have what some consider the star of the show and the main feature of tonight's class. We have in this box, this specially crafted cardboard Jewish box. Why do I say Jewish? Because it's got Hebrew lettering on it. We have inside foam padding, and inside that is carefully encased an esrog.
Is that from Israel?
These are from Israel. This guy, this white box, is from Italy. These are not China. No, that would be hilarious. No, this is from Italy. These are designer
cardboard box.
Right. These are designer, not designer. No, we're going to talk about that in a second. So these are Italian. This one in my hand is Israel. I'll open up the Italian soon. Okay. Smells amazing. By the way, last year, did I tell you my story last year? I bought an Esrog, spent a lot of money. Turns out it wasn't real. I got a lemon. The good news is, Charnin knows. I triple up all the time. Listen, the good news is the lemon laws. All right, I know, not the same season. You're right. Okay, so this is the dealio. We're going to talk about today the Esrog. Now, the Esrog dates back. I'm talking about genetically. There are signs of Esrog dating back at least 5,000 years. In other words, it goes back very far. The first traces of Esrog, interestingly enough, according to science at least, is India. Yeah. These originally grew in India. These were used in ancient times by ancient people. Like, for example, the Romans had a use for it, and the Romans had a use for it, and I think the Greeks had a use for it. Various nations had various uses for it. The ancient Egyptians had a use. I think they used this to help embalming. Is that what it's called? Embalm? Yeah, when they would embalm like the deceased,
right.
Used to use it.
Mummify.
And I think, yeah, mummify or whatever it is.
Depending
on gender. Then you have the Romans who use this to keep moths away. God. You ever smell mothballs? You know mothballs?
Yeah.
These are better. They smell better.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll work. And it's a lot of money to spend on that. I'm telling you that much. But that's what the ancient Romans used to use it for. Now, the first time we find a Jewish connection with the Esrog, Let's crack open the books over here, or the handouts. Take a look at text number one. Lisa, please get us started. This is page 288 from Leviticus, the first mention of the good old citron, the Esrog plant in Torah.
The Esrog. And you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of a beautiful tree, date, palm, fronds, a branch of a braided tree, and willows of the brook. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for a 7-day period.
So here we go. The Torah says take four things. Number one, the fruit of a beautiful tree. Number two, date, palm, fronds. Now, see if we can identify together these four items. So let's start with number two. Date, palm, fronds, this guy right here. Branch of a braided tree. Braided tree is the Hadas, these guys, the myrtle. The willows of the brook, willows. So where is Esrog stated in this? It's the first one. Fruit of a beautiful tree. Now, talk about a euphemism, or talk about not being specific, right? It doesn't say take an Esrog. It says take a pre-Eitz Hadar. Take a fruit of a beautiful tree. Now, listen, beauty is in the eyes of?
The beholder.
So if I ask you, what's your favorite fruit? What do you think is tastes the best or looks the nicest? You're going to have a different answer than you, and probably than me. So the Torah is very vague. It says, take a beautiful tree, as if we know what it is. Listen to this carefully. There are many disputes in the Talmud. You know, when it comes to there are many disputes in the Talmud as to what the Torah means. There's never, ever been a dispute as to what the Torah meant, as to what God meant when God said, take the fruit of a beautiful tree. Why? You don't think rabbis differed on what's beautiful? Of course they did. Why has there never been a disagreement about using an esrog? There's no one in Jewish history that ever said, take something else. It's always been an esrog. But esrog is not mentioned in the Torah. So how do we know this? Rambam says, Maimonides says, from here is an indication. This is one of the many indications that along with the written text of Torah, God gave Moses a verbal explanation. So God says, write this down. Take the fruit of a beautiful tree. I'm telling you what it means, and make sure to tell everyone else it means the esrog, or the etrog. I'm just going to pronounce it like the Ashkenazi way. The esrog. That's what it means. And Moses told it to us, and we told it to they told it to their kids, their students, etc. And for the last 3,331 years or so, this has been the story. It hasn't changed. And this is why we use an esrog, because we know that that's what it means, because that's what it means. Text to Peter, read this. Here's how Maimonides spells this out for us.
We do not find any debate regarding the verse that states the fruit of a beautiful tree, that one opinion should state that it is an etrog, another counter is that it's a pomegranate and or any other fruit, because the interpretation is an established tradition for Moses.
And that last line, there's no debate. Why? Because the interpretation is an established tradition for Moses. That's a key line. I don't want that to get lost in the shuffle. What that means is there are certain things that we don't know. Certain things that the rabbis had to deduce from the text, and that you find machloket, you find dispute amongst the sages. Because there are different ways to deduce the text from the original when you don't have the clarity. But this is not a deduction. This was not something that the sages figured out. Yeah, we think it's an esrog based on our best guess. If that's what it was, you would have one guy that would have said an esrog, the other guy would have said a pomegranate, the other guy would have said whatever, something else. This is a tradition from Moses. It's in the Hebrew, mikubalim mimoshe. You know what the word Kabbalah? Kabbalah, which we know as mysticism, Kabbalah really means to receive. It's a received tradition. This is part of the received oral tradition. Moses got it from God, told it to us. The story has never changed. There's no other story.
So this was brought down well before they were actually able to do the mitzvah? Because Moses received this in the desert, but they were...
No, they had. It says, according to the Midrash. Yeah. This will blow your mind. I think we'll have it later in one of the texts. According to the Midrash, God took Moses, flew him over to Italy, hooked him, that's what it says, hooked him up with an esrog. Yeah, that's what it says.
So we know from the Midrash that it was Italy and not India?
We know that it's Italy.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what the Midrash says. Now, if you're wondering where Corfu comes in, because that's not Italy, that's Greece. Yeah, that's a different musical. So, we're going to get there in a second. We're going to introduce all of this. It's going to get amazing and complicated in a good way. And it's going to get intense, not for us, but we're going to look back on some intense debates amongst European Jews and develop a profound love story in all of this. But we're going to get there. Let's keep on developing this. Now, take a look at text number 3. Howard, please read this one. Nachmanides Ramban, not Rambam, Maimonides, but Nachmanides, explains the following regarding the word pre-eitz hadar. The Hebrew word, again, the Hebrew says pre-eitz, the fruit of a tree, that is hadar, that is beautiful. And we said, well, what's beautiful? Well, thank God for Moses that he heard it from God and he told us what it is, so we know. But the Ramban says, you know what? Even the word hadar, which means beautiful, tells us what it is. We know hadar is an esrog. Why? Because they both mean the same thing.
The translation of the word esrog is desirable. Onkelos renders the translation pleasurable to the eye, with the word etymologically linked with the word esrog, as well as the translation for the words do not covet. Pleasure and beauty are the theoretically similar.
So the truth is, this interpretation really works much better in the Hebrew because it's all about Hebrew words. But I'll give you the short of what he just said there because it's really important. He says the word esrog means desirable, or pleasurable, something that is delectable, something that's it's beautiful. That's the word esrog. And the word hadar, pre-Eitz Hadar, means the fruit of a beautiful tree. So he said the word esrog, we know in biblical language, esrog means beautiful, and hadar means beautiful. And so when the Torah says the fruit of a beautiful tree, what is beautiful, literally that's what the word esrog means. So that's how we know that it's an esrog. That's according to Nachmanides. The text number four. I love this one. Sharna.
What type of tree did Adam and Eve eat from? Rabbi Abba of Acher said it was an etrog tree.
Rabbi Abba says, you know what they ate? Not the apple. Right, we always think Adam and Eve, they ate from an apple, forbidden fruit, an apple. Who says apple? You should know the Talmud has different opinions, because this was not a tradition from Moses. So there is different opinions about how to deduce which fruit, which type of fruit they ate. Not one opinion in the Talmud. No, there's no Jewish source that says it was an apple. You know where the apple comes from? The apple comes from renditions of art that depict it as an apple. Now, why did they depict it as an apple? You got to ask them. But there's no Jewish source. I mean, listen, if you want to know what the Bible says, it probably makes sense to go to the original people of the book to figure out what it means, right? There's no original Jewish source that says it was an apple. Some say pomegranate, some say esrog, some say different, like four or five different opinions. But here we have this mention of an esrog. Why is this relevant here? Because it says that Eve saw that it was beautiful. That it was a tav. Nechmad, it was beautiful to look at, beautiful in appearance, and it was beautiful to eat. And so she ate it, she gave it to Adam, he ate it, he also must have liked it, and the rest is history. The point is, what is beautiful? The esrog, and that's why that opinion says that. What did they eat? They ate the beautiful fruit, the esrog.
Is the word hiddur mitzvah for the same
thing? Yes, word? Perfect, exactly. Hiddur mitzvah, which means to beautify a mitzvah, is the same thing, creates hadar, exactly. Which again, hidur, all of that means beautiful. The key here is that that's also what esrog means. Yeah. And here we have this connection. Now, hidur mitzvah means to do a mitzvah, but in a beautiful way. So you could do a mitzvah in a basic way to fulfill the obligation, or do it in an even more beautiful way. So like an esrog, people get really into it. Like you could spend, I don't know, you could spend $30, $50, $75, $150, $300, $500, spend $1,000 on an esrog. So the difference is, it's a great question. It's the shape of the esrog. It's the color of the esrog. It's the bumps of the esrog. It's the
symmetry.
You see, notice this ducks a little, right? It's right. If there are spots at all,
blemishes.
Huh? Blemishes, yeah, exactly. Then some people won't. So again, it depends. You know, you kind of get what you pay for. And listen.
No, it's a work of nature.
Right. 100%. Listen, it's right. I understand that position, but somebody says, you know, I want an esrog. I want to do the mitzvah, and I want it to look beautiful. So they go all out. It's like there are many examples where you can do this. You know, people have different standards of. I'll give you an example, and this is an example that's taken root in Jewish custom for pretty much everybody. The Talmud says that for Hanukkah, the basic way to observe the holiday is to light one candle each night. Like one, not two the next night. No. One candle per household each night. So day one, light a candle. Day two, light a candle. Day three, light a candle. If you really want to be muhudar, mehadrin, again, hadar, same thing. If you want to be beautiful, if you want to beautify the mitzvah, then light one candle per member of the household. And if you want to be mehadrin, mina mehadrin, then each night add a light, which is what we do. So everyone does the hiddur mitzvah, the double beautification of it. But again, I don't want to go too far off the point. The point here is that when the Torah says it's a beautiful fruit, we know it means esrog. Now, the Talmud helps us with hints from the biblical phrase, pre-Eitz Hadar, a beautiful fruit, or fruit from a beautiful tree. The Talmud says four rationales why that means the esrog. Steve. Text number five.
Our rabbis have taught the fruit of a hadar tree implies a tree the taste of whose fruit and wood is the same. They then that it is the etrog.
Yeah.
Rabbi said, read not hadar, but hadir, the pen. Just as a pen contains large and small animals, perfect and blemished ones, so too the fruit spoken of must have large and small, perfect and blemished. Rabbi Abahu said, read not Hadar, but Hadar, a fruit that dwells in its tree all year round. Ben Azay said, read not Hadar, but Hudar, for in Greek water is called Hudar. Now the fruit is it that grows near every water. Say, of course, it is the Etrog.
Thank you. I will unpack all four expositions here because it's really cool. Okay, the first opinion, there are four different paragraphs and four different rabbis extract from the Torah text hints that we're talking about the Etrog specifically from a plant perspective, from a fruit perspective, and here's why. The first opinion says, look at the phrase of the Torah. It says, pre eats Hadar, which means the fruit of a tree that is beautiful. Why not just say pre-Hadar, a beautiful fruit? Why does it say pre-eats Hadar, the fruit of a beautiful tree? Why does it add the word tree? So our sages say, you know what it means, pre-eats Hadar? It means a fruit that the fruit and the tree itself taste the same, which means the Etrog tree, the actual bark of the Etrog tree, has a similar smell, has a similar flavor, essence flavor. The oils are of a similar flavor in the actual branches, the stem, the bark of the tree has the aroma of the Etrog in it, similar oils, as does the Etrog itself. Now, this one might say, well, that's not unusual because all citrus trees are kind of like that. But there's a distinction. Why? Because when it comes to the Etrog, there's very little fruit inside. Most of it is rind. It's very thick and it's white, thick. So if you like look right behind the yellow layer, if you will, it's thick, white rind. Inside, there's only a little bit of fruit, like pulpy fruit. But most of it is the rind. Whereas most citrus fruits, like an orange, right, you peel an orange, you have a little bit of the white that you also can peel off or not. And then most of it is the edible fruit, correct? Same thing is true with a lemon, etc. The Etrog is very unique. The rind, that flavor is the same type of flavor or odor, smell, scent, etc. that's in the actual branch of the tree. So when our sages say that the Etrog is a tree, very unique tree, that the tree is a very unique fruit because its tree and its fruit taste the same, what it means is that bulk of this, which is the rind, is similar to the tree, which has the same flavor. Does that make sense? Sort of? Okay. Let's move on to the next one. Rebbe said, we're going back to text number 5. Rebbe said, this is again a non-literal interpretation. He says, the word is Hadar, beautiful. Pre-Eitz Hadar, beautiful, fruit of a beautiful tree. But he says, don't read it as Hadar, beautiful, but rather Hadir. What does Hadir mean? Hadir means the pen. Like a pen that encloses a lot of animals, different size animals, different age animals, etc. So too, the Etrog tree has different size fruits, different age fruits, blemished, unblemished, etc. And let me explain what that means. The Etrog is unique amongst citrus fruits. Most citrus fruits, they ripen, and at the end of the season, they're ready to be picked. And if you don't pick it, you know what happens? They fall off the tree. The Etrog can stay up to 3 years. One Etrog, the same Etrog, can grow for up to 3 years, maybe even a little bit more, on the same tree, which means that year two, you have two, whatever. At any given time, you might have 3-year-old Etrogim, 2-year-old Etrogim, 1-year-old Etrogim, baby Etrogim that are just budding now. You can have the whole lifespan, right? Cross-section. Most fruit trees and citrus fruit trees as well, they kind of start off and end at the same time. The Etrog is different. You have all types at the same time. Hence, the allusion in the text when it says Hadar, because Torah doesn't have vowels, so you can take the consonants and have fun with it from a homiletical interpretation level. So Hadar, Hadir, the pen that has all sorts of a collection of different size animals, different ages. The next, yeah.
Is there a limit to how big they grow?
I've seen them this big.
Seriously, yeah.
Yep.
Like a mini football?
Yeah. Yeah. The Rebbe always had a very big one. No, legit. Remind me, because I won't remember necessarily. Remind me afterwards. We'll Google it. I can pull it up on my phone. I'll show you an example. Yeah. Italian. Now, Rabbi Abbo, the third explanation, he says, don't read Hadar, but read?
Hadar.
Don't read Hadar, but Hadar, which means it's a fruit that dwells. Dar means to dwell, like Dira is a dwelling place, like a house. Hadar means a fruit that dwells on a tree all year round. Again, it doesn't fall off. Same idea. It doesn't fall off after it's ripe, but it goes year round. The Asrogim stay all year round. I don't know how your trees are doing over there. Yeah. But that's at least theoretically the way it works with these trees. Now, at least with the ones that they were referring to. Ben Azai said, huh?
The fruit's still good year after year.
It is. Still kosher. Yeah. Now, Ben Azai says, don't read Hadar. I love this one. But read Hydar, right? Like hydrate, you know, like water, hydro, whatever, yeah. From the Greek, right? Why? Because the Esther tree is unique. It needs lots of water. By rain alone, it will not survive. Most fruit trees will survive by rain alone. The Esrog tree, at least the ones in Italy that they were talking about, need irrigation. It needs some sort of irrigation. It has to grow near water, or you have to pull water there, if not, in order for it to grow. Anyway, so those are the four allusions. Now, let's get into some details. So it seems pretty simple. When I say simple, what do I mean? Look for an Esrog. And you're good to go. Like, this doesn't seem to be complicated. If it's an Esrog, it's an Esrog, and it's kosher. It's one of the four types. It's the most expensive one of the four, and it's like the primary one because it's, I don't know, it gets the most like media play, whatever. The Esrog is like the center of attention, right? And it's the only one that's not green. I feel like Kermit the Frog would have something to say about that. Yeah. It's not easy being green, but for this guy, it's not easy to be yellow for this guy. The point is that the Esrog seems to be fairly easy to choose. However, there is a monkey wrench, a massive monkey wrench. There's always a monkey wrench. What's the monkey wrench?
Here's the Esrogs down.
No. I'll tell you what I mean about the monkey wrench. The Esrog tree is very fragile. It's extremely fragile. It takes about 5 years before it starts producing Esrogim. A good 5 years of growth before anything comes out. And they only last for about 10 to 15 years. So it's a lot of cultivation and TLC for very little payoff. Therefore, listen to this. There is a massive, massive temptation to graft. So here's how grafting works. I actually saw, in preparation for this class, a YouTube tutorial about how to graft trees.
Yep.
And now I know how to do it. I feel very confident.
Mazel tov.
Yeah, I can do it. So what's the chachma of grafting? So there are different reasons why one would graft. I'm going to get back to the Esrog in a second. The YouTube video that I saw, this guy is like, why, if you like different types of apples, why have like four different apple trees? That's so amateurish. You can take one tree and have four different types of apples from the same tree. That's brilliant. I'm like, I didn't know that existed. Wizardry. So here's what you do. By the way, this is forbidden in Torah law. You should know. Kliyim. Grafting is forbidden.
Well,
that's why I didn't make this video. I'm right. You can't do it in the ground. You can't do it above the ground. This guy, he's like, here's what you do. You cut off a branch. Oh, you take like a branch, like a small branch from whatever it is that you want. So let's say you have different types of apples. Give me a type of apple.
Gala.
What else?
Fuji.
Macca.
Now we have too many. Honeycrisp. Ah, too much. We have to stick with two. So let's say Honeycrisp. Why not?
I like it.
Right. We all like it. A little tart, though. I don't know. All right. So Honeycrisp. So you like the Honeycrisp, but you want it on your Fuji. It's a whole thing. Right? This is Fuji. I want Honeycrisp also. I don't want to have to plant another tree. Who has the time? So I cut a little bit of a thing from a Honeycrisp, and then I go over to my Fuji. I cut another thing, and I take, like this guy did, take like a box cutter. That's what he did. And you cut. Yeah. You cut it like the branch is sticking out.
Yep.
You cut it like right through a little bit.
Yep.
And then you wedge that bad boy in there. Mm-hmm. You wedge the guy into the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
The dude wrapped it in tape.
Yeah.
Grafting tape.
It's a good use of duct tape.
No, grafting tape this guy had that naturally after it seals, whatever, at some point disintegrates. So you don't have to unwrap it even. It's so natural and biodegradable. It's amazing.
Well, to water the graft as it grows?
Yeah, oh, he has grafting. He has grafting. What's it called again? He had a grafting. What is it?
No.
It's almost like a glue, but kind of like. It was like a solid bar. It was like orangish, bronzish, and he melted it, and then it was melty, and then like a wax.
Wax.
There you go. Grafting wax. Anyway, this guy had pulled all the stops. This guy was very convincing. I'm like, still can't do it though. I can't do it. So anyway, this guy can do whatever he wants. Not my issue. But listen, so here's the thing. The esrog tree is very fragile. The lemon tree, super strong. So imagine, you want to take the roots, the foundation, the base of a lemon, hakarain, which means put into it, the esrog. What's going to come out? Esrog. But it's going to have the foundation, the strength, the base of the lemon. Lemon trees last 30, 35 years. This is good news, but not for the Jews. The question is, well, let's ask it as a question. Is it kosher? Does it blend? That's a different commercial, right? Hold on 1 second. So what comes out? What comes out is esrog, we would think. Or we can at least ask the question. Do we say that what comes out from the graft is an esrog and therefore it's kosher? Or do we say it's grafted, not kosher? Here's the amazing thing. First of all, it's forbidden to do so. Text number 6. The question though is not, is it forbidden? The question is it an esrog? Two different things. Text number 6. Adina Mak, I think we're up to you. 291.
Oh, this is a great one. Okay. Grafting a mixture of trees is included in the prohibition. You shall not sow your field with mixed species. What is implied when a person grafts a tree of one species onto a tree of another species, for example, he grafted a branch of an apple tree to an etrog tree, or from an etrog tree to an apple tree, he is liable for lashes, according to scriptural law, in any place, whether in Israel or in the diaspora.
I looked up that guy's address. I got my... I'm going to send him lashes. I'm going to send him, like...
Eyelashes.
Yeah, it's like... Dude, joking. No joke. I'm not. No, nothing. I have no problem with the dude. No, I appreciate his video because I see what it is. Anyway, so it's prohibited according to Jewish law. But the question is not, are you allowed to do it? The question is it an esrog? Is it an esrog? Now, hold on 1 second. There's two questions. First of all, if it was done in prohibition, is it still kosher to use? That's one question. Hold on. Let's ask another question. If someone violated this and created, even planting different seeds together, and created a new type of fruit, are you allowed to eat it?
No.
You are.
Yeah.
Tangelo, knock yourself out. You can't do it, but you can eat it. Yeah. We found the loophole. No, I'm kidding. The prohibition is against doing it, but it doesn't render it forbidden. Two different things.
Okay.
The prohibition is against doing it, but you're still allowed to eat it when it comes to the seeds. The question is, are you still allowed to use it for the mitzvah of the esrog? That's one question. Second question is it an esrog or is it a lemon? Or is it a lemon esrog? Now, I'm going to give you the Hebrew word. It's called morkav. Morkav means a cross. Morkav means hybrid, grafted. Morkav. The Talmud, which is like the big place where all these things are debated and discussed, Talmud doesn't have any discussion about a esrog morkav. A grafted hybrid esrog. It doesn't talk about it. And so the halakhic authorities that lived a little bit later in the 1400s, 1500s, when this became a more widespread practice, were faced with a massive question. The question is, grafted esrogim, yay or nay? Kosher or not kosher? Nearly all of the great rabbis, talking about the Alshich, we're talking about the Ramah, talking about the great Maram Padua, they all came out, most of them came out with a proclamation saying, it's not kosher. You can't use it for an esrog. A grafted esrog is not kosher. Why? There are different rationales. We're going to explore three of them, three different rationales why it should not be kosher. Yeah.
You said they were doing this practice, so they weren't grafting the tree. I'm assuming other people were grafting the tree, then we get the fruit after.
Yeah. Because the rabbis or the Jewish community wasn't necessarily the farmers. They didn't have to be. The question is, can you buy it from an orchard of Esrogim that has been grafted? That's the question. To do it, we know you can't do it. And to graft, to do the grafting yourself, can't do the grafting.
But like having a Shabbos boy, like somebody else.
Someone did it. Someone grafted. I didn't graft. Someone grafted.
It wasn't not kosher to do it. But, you know, could it be that the ones that had the trees that were, you know, that were fragile and all that, that they, you know, were big donors and they said, look, I know, I'm going to put aside business.
Hard for me to speculate, but I'll tell you, but there are solid rationales for why the grafted esrog is not kosher. Aside from the prohibition, well, including the prohibition, but take a look at text number 7. This is coming from the Alter Rebbe, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, in his Code of Jewish Law. He has his own edition of the Code of Jewish Law with beautiful explanations. 292, Joel.
If one grafts another tree onto the esrog tree and it produces a fruit similar to an esrog, the fruit is disqualified for use in the holiday. So this is not an esrog at all. Rather, it is an altogether different creation.
So the Alter Rebbe talks about the opposite case. If you graft something else, let's say a lemon, onto an esrog, but the truth is it would work either way. The Alter Rebbe's core reasoning is when you take two things and you graft them together, you graft one thing to the other, what results from that is not a pure breed of either one of them. And therefore, the Torah says to use an esrog. This is not an esrog. You can call a lemon esrog, or a lesrog, or an elma, whatever.
A lemtrog.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that one. Yeah. Almost like Lemberg. Like Yvonne. Right, so it's close, it's whatever, but it's not a pure situation. So
God did not create this.
Nope. God did not create this hybrid. And so, again, the specific argument for prohibition that the Alter Rebbe puts forth is it's not an esrog at all. Rather, it's an altogether different creation. It doesn't matter what it is. It might be beautiful. It might be nice. It's not an esrog. You're supposed to use an esrog. This is not an esrog, simply. Let's do the next one. Take a look at the alsha.
If somebody uses it, is it worse? I mean, does someone get credit for attempting? I mean, if they know it's...
The question here is, listen, you're asking a good question, and the truth is I was going to save that for the end of the class. I was going to say, so like, what's the big deal? Right? But hold that to the end of the class, because I want to address that
so
then.
Does anybody do what I would call an autogenous graft, where you would graft an esrog that was at the end of its life cycle to a young esrog tree?
I don't mature it faster.
Because it's an esrog to an esrog. I'm not sure. That's a great question.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure. It's a good question. Let's take a look at the alshach.
I have a variant of that question. Is it kosher if it's hydroponically grown, because you could control for a lot of the fragility of the esrog tree if you grew it hydroponically?
That's also a good question. I'm not sure.
I don't think it's hydroponic.
It may be. I'll tell you why it might be a problem. It's kosher to eat. Hydroponic is kosher to eat, right? Because there's nothing not kosher about it. But when the Torah says pre-eats hadar, the fruit of a beautiful tree, would this be considered a tree if it's grown hydroponically? If it's just the fruit growing, I don't know that it has the same...
The tree.
I don't know. I'm not sure how that works. Without roots, you know, in the ground...
So it's got to be in the ground.
I'm not saying for sure, but I'm saying that might be, without saying that I don't know the answer, but that could be a challenge. I know when it comes to, let's say, hydroponic lettuce, the question is, can you use that for marar on Passover? Passover for the romaine lettuce? Can you use hydroponic romaine lettuce? Now, understand the value of that. The value of that is less bugs. You can't eat bugs, right? Bugs are not kosher. So you have to check all these pieces of lettuce. You have to check it. Hydroponic, you may have less of an issue.
You don't have any.
Well, hopefully not, right? You never know, right? Because who knows? But you still have to check. But you have much less of an issue. The question is it considered to be the same status of lettuce? Is it a shahakol? Right? Is it something, you say the blessing of something that grows from the ground, if it doesn't grow from the ground? So, I'm not answering the question, I'm just saying it's a question. It's not just a slam dunk that would be fine. Let's take a look at the Alshach, text number 8, 293.
halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda, who states that an etrog smaller than the size of an egg is invalid. Now, if the grafted etrog is the size of an egg, how can it be kosher? The actual size of etrog within the fruit is only half of a...
Beitzah is an egg. I'll tell you what he says. Basically, the Talmud says that if you have an etrog, the minimum size of an etrog is the size of an egg. Oh, like Steve had a small etrog before, right, from last year. But the etrog has to be at least the size of an average size egg. Otherwise, it's not kosher. But what if it's the size of an egg? It's kosher. Yeah, what if it's grafted? Then even though it's the size of an egg, what percentage of that is etrog versus lemon? And then do you have enough etrog of the size of an egg? And if not, now you have this rule, this weird rule, where you can no longer use the egg as a measure of what constitutes a kosher etrog. Because if it's a hybrid grafted etrog, size of an egg, it's still not kosher. Till what size?
Egg.
No, but an egg, it's hybrid, it's grafted, so not all of it is etrog.
So, yeah.
But so how do you know, how are you ever going to measure? How are you going to biologically know? Two eggs? You have to double it?
How much is it going to
add to it?
You don't know. So his point is this whole thing smells funny, smells fishy. Beitzah is an egg. I don't know why they didn't translate it. Beitzah is the same thing as an egg. Continue, another issue?
Another issue is that halacha states that an incomplete etrog is invalid. Now, grafted etrog is really half lemon, so it is an incomplete etrog.
In other words, if you have an etrog and you cut out a chunk, not kosher. So he says, essentially, when you've grafted an etrog, there's a chunk in it that's lemon. So it's like a chunk missing. So it's an incomplete etrog. So how could it be kosher? Again, we have two arguments so far. Number one, it's not an etrog. Number two, it's not a whole etrog. Number three, text number nine, the Levush.
Some wish to permit the usage of certain etrogen that come from the orchards of Gertesia. But I say that they are invalid by scriptural law. These etrogen were grafted with other trees, such as oranges and lemons. Because they are the product of a transgression, though they are permissible for consumption, they are detestable to God.
So that was the argument that we said before, we alluded to before. Since it came through the violation of a prohibition against grafting, even though it's kosher to eat. But you want to do a mitzvah with this? You think God's going to like it? You're going to take a grafted etrog and say, God, look what I did for you. God's like, I said no grafting. Right? If you didn't do it, you can eat it, whatever, fine, loophole, something, but you're going to use it as a mitzvah and say, God, look what I got for you. I grafted this, or somebody grafted this. Come on. It's not nice. It's distasteful. So why? How could it be good? Some explain, some counter this specific rationale for prohibition and say, well, there's no prohibition. The prohibition is only against a Jew to graft. Someone who's not Jewish is allowed to graft. I know just this, so I'm saying, so if that's the case, then it was never done in prohibition. Understand? How? He says it's detestable for God because a prohibition was, because a violation happened. But maybe there was no violation. If the farmer was not Jewish, then that farmer has no prohibition against grafting. Therefore, there's no prohibition. Therefore, it's not detestable. Again, you have different arguments on this one, but overall, the vast majority, maybe you have one or two opinions amongst many dozens. You have maybe one opinion that says maybe grafting could be okay. But by and large, grafting was out. But here's the problem. You ready for this? How are you going to know what's grafted and what's ungrafted? Somebody grafted it. Yeah? And then you have an etrog. So maybe you can look back at that tree. Wonderful. But what happens to the next generation? You take a seed from this guy and you plant it. And then a tree grows. That tree is not grafted anywhere, but maybe it came from an etrog that came from a tree that was grafted. So now, all of the etrogim in the whole world could be called into question because you just don't know. How are you going to know? In other words, if an etrog has to be ungrafted, pure, not hybrid, pure etrog stock from the beginning of time, pure etrog stock, if that's the requirement, how do we know that what we're holding in our hand is that pure stock? Even if you look at the tree that it came from, how do you know that that tree came from something that wasn't grafted? Right, exactly. So the Alter Rebbe explains in text number 10 that there are certain factors, certain identifying marks that can help us identify what's grafted or what's ungrafted.
There are four indicators that distinguish a grafted hybrid etrog from a pure etrog. The skin of a grafted etrog is smooth, whereas a pure etrog has a bumpy surface with minor protrusions. the stem of a grafted etrog protrudes from the bottom of the lemon, whereas the stem of a pure etrog is embedded inward. A grafted etrog has an abundance of edible flesh and juice within a thin peel, whereas a pure etrog has a thick peel and little juicy flesh. And a pure etrog seeds grow in the same direction as the length of the fruit, whereas a grafted etrog often have their seeds growing in the same direction as the width of the fruit.
Four signs. By the way, these distinguish an etrog from a lemon, straight up. A lemon has smooth skin, an etrog has bumpy skin. So grafted ones may have smoother skin than pure etrogim. The same thing is true with the stem. The lemon protrudes, the etrog is embedded. It moves more toward inward. Grafted etrog has, like I said before, I mentioned before in the different context, has a lot of fruit. It's got a lot of pulp and juice inside where because it's lemon of nature. It has a lemon features, whereas a pure etrog has more rind. And the last one is the direction the seeds grow. Do they grow kind of along the length of the etrog or sideways? Whatever. Different. Come back after the holiday. These things are way too expensive to do surgery on them. No autopsies yet. Wait till after the chag. Now, huh? Well, you can cut a neighboring one, right? You can take one for the team. Now let's talk about Carfu. Carfu, so to me, I looked it up. I'm like, oh, cool, it's beautiful. It's like on the Mediterranean. It's the northwestern part of Greece. It's a gorgeous island. It's a large island, fairly large island. And here's the deal. Let me explain what's going on here. The Ashkenazic Jews, Poland, Hungary, Eastern Europe, Russia, they had a hard time getting estrogen. Why? Because they don't grow there. It's too cold. Estrogen grow in very warm climates. They don't grow in grow in Poland. Not happening. It's not gonna happen. Remember, estrogen have to grow all year round. So anything that has a harsh winter, you're out. You're done. Dunsies. Not happening. Yeah, none in Montreal either. You're just not growing it there. So how did they get estrogen? They had to import them from. Remember, importing back like 500 years ago was not easy. Try to import something. What do you do? Send a text? Like, how are you getting it? Who's coming in? Who's coming in? Who, what, where, when? There's like a pogroms and stuff and like expulsions happening and like you're trying to like get a hold of an estrog. So it was very hard often to get a hold of an estrog. Sometimes there are many stories about communities, whole communities where they had one estrog for the whole community and everyone had to bless the same estrog. And then the klutz comes and drops it and like the pitum breaks up. I'm kidding, I just made that part up. That would be terrible. But like, whatever, the pitum is this guy. So the pitum, just parenthetically, if this thing breaks off, it's no good.
Really?
Now, that's not a grin, we don't do that. It's like.
If this then breaks up, it's no good?
I just like that grenade motion. Huh? No, yeah, if this.
The IDF is looking for you.
Yeah, no. This is.
The stem
is at the bottom. I don't want to show it because this one protrudes, so whatever. I'm sure it's still fine. But anyway, this guy, it grows this way, and this is, like, I don't know what you call this, the pitum. How do we say pitum in English? Pitum. Anyway, if this thing breaks off, no good. We saw one back there that had this off. And I'm sure the seller's like, it grew that way. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. By the way, there are some Italians that grow like that. Legit. Anyway, getting back to the discussion. So what happens is, this Sfardim, Ashkenazim had a hard time. Sfardim, who settled kind of North Africa, Mediterranean region, Italy, those areas, they had some collections over there. They had access. And they were using for a while from Carfu, the ones from Greece, the Greek island. And then they somehow made their way up to the Ashkenazic lands, Germany, Poland, Hungary. And these were beautiful estrogim. They were so beautiful from Carfu. They were so beautiful that the rabbi said, too good to be true. These things look too good. They look too robust. They look too strong. We've been getting weathered and withered and like Nebuchy, God forbid it's a mitzvah, but we're getting these type of estrogim that look like they're on their last. And these are coming now suddenly, this whole influx from Carfu. Something's awry. Perhaps it's Murkav, perhaps it's a hybrid grafted. So what happens is the rabbis start weighing in. So the first The first rabbi that weighs in the early 1800s, this happens around the 1800s, 1850s, is Rabbi Ephraim Zalman Margolis, text number 11. Who are we up to? Did you read? Oh, go ahead.
The conclusion of my ruling is that the Etrogan that we now see coming from the island of Corfu or other places where the gardeners cultivate trees for Etrog sales are free from any concerns of grafting. One is allowed to recite the blessing over them without reservation, even if there are other options available. It is common practice just to specifically choose these Etrogan as they are beautiful specimens. It is best to let the practice of Israel continue, for they are not prophets.
And that last, he doesn't mean non-profit, although also what he means is because who knows? Who knows if grafted or not? We just go by what our eye sees. It looks like an Etrog, smells like an Etrog, tastes like an Etrog, quacks like an Etrog. It's probably a duck. It's probably a lemon. No, it's probably an Etrog. So that's what he says. This first rabbi weighs in. He's the first one to weigh in on it. He says, look, I've spoken to some guys. It seems legit. We don't know, but it's impossible to know. So he says, I'm going to call it kosher. Fine. That's his opinion. You have dissenting opinions. A few years later, we have the Chasam Sofer, a great rabbi in Pressburg. Pressburg today is Bratislava. Yeah, Bratislava. Anyway, so he says, nope, not kosher. Not kosher. Why? Because even though it may have the signs, the four signs of an Etrog that we mentioned before, those signs don't make it kosher. Those signs are only disqualifying signs when you think it's kosher, but it's not that, then it could be disqualified. But that doesn't make a thing kosher. That doesn't constitute its kashrut. You have to have a tradition that it's kosher, and the only tradition we have as a community is Italy, not Greece. We don't have Corfu as a tradition. We have Calabria. We have a different tradition. Or from Yanov, from Genoa, but not we don't have from Corfu. That's a new one. Text 12.
I've already written in another response that the indicators of the Dur Etrog are not of biblical origin, nor are they mentioned in the Talmud or any other early source. Thus, halakhically speaking, the law of an Etrog is similar to that of Dur. Only ones with a tradition are considered kosher. Accordingly, Etrogim that come from Genoa are the time-tested kosher Etrogim, for it is these Etrogim that our ancestors from many generations back in France and other European countries traditionally used, and they do not need any indicating signs to be considered kosher.
Continue, please.
Sorry.
No worries.
Signs were only devised to distinguish between the Etrogan that came from Genoa and similar places. In an instance where they were not present on a certain Etrog, they were able to determine that it was not a traditional kosher specimen. However, with regard to the Etrogan that come from other islands, even if they possess the appropriate indicators, it does not prove that they are not grafted. The conclusion of this discussion is that any Etrog that is not from Genoa should not be used unless there is a clear kosher sign that testifies that it is not grafted, and one cannot rely on signs. Peace be unto the one who feeds these words.
So, thank you. So we have one rabbi who says it's kosher from Corfu, from Greece, from the Greek island, and one rabbi who says it's not kosher, don't use it. See what's going on here? Yeah.
So what about if it came from Corsica?
Where's Corsica?
Corsica depends on what period of history you want to talk about. Could be French, could be Italian, could be Greek, but
so,
usually Italian.
Okay, so here's the thing. What he's basically saying is unless it comes from those orchards that we know, okay, that we've always been taking it from,
okay,
that the Midrash said that God took Moses to and collapsed.
So it's got to be Genoa.
It's got to, yeah. And Genoa, by the way, just to be clear here, Genoa was the port city where it came up, but that's not where it grew. It grew in Calabria, which is the toe of the boot of Italy, near the water, grew there, and then it went up to the port, to Genoa, and that's where it went to be kind of distributed. That's like the place of origin on the box, if you will, on the label. The point is, that's where we knew that they came from and were kosher, and he's saying any newfangled Etrogim, even if they look cool and they look legit, and even if they possess the four signs, we just don't know that they're not hybrid, that they're not grafted, and therefore it's not cool. Now we're gonna do some quick like
and
rapid fire.
Rabbi
Moshe Sofer, 1800s.
Okay.
Yeah, early 1800s. Yeah.
What did you say about the Etrog that came from North Africa?
No, in North Africa, they were using ones in the Mediterranean, and they were using ones from Italy, but also ones from Greece. And the Sephardim were using the ones from Greece. And the Ashkenazic rabbi said, not so fast. For our communities, not so fast. We don't have a tradition. Our tradition is from Italy, not from Greece. Now, take a look at text 13. Here we have another opinion. David, text 13, 299.
O great ones of Israel, hearken to my words. I have already published my views to exhort those who tremble before God. Sadly, due to our many sins, a great sin was committed in Israel, for there are people who have testified that the etrogim imported from the island of Korkor kosher. In fact, these etrogim are the efforts of conniving people who plotted together to trick the rabbi there to think that they were, in fact, thrown in Parga. The conclusion we emerge with is that we should not consider any etrogim kosher unless we are absolutely confident that it comes from a kosher orchard and that is traditionally accepted as an orchard free from any grafted trees, and confident that all the great rabbis in Israel will agree with my position.
So he says you can't take from Corfu either. You can only take from Parga, which is another place in Greece. He happened to be an importer from that. This rabbi happened to be... I'm just saying, this is the fact. He happened to be an importer of etrogim from Parga. That was how he made a lot of his money. And he said, those are kosher because I verified and I can testify. The ones from Corfu don't have a tradition and therefore don't get from them. Fine. I'll read text 14. And here we have another opinion. The conclusive ruling, this is another rabbi who says, all etrogim from Parga, Preveza and Agia and Arpanasa have always been kosher. He says, for these three locations are equally good without distinction. There's no concern of grafting from these places. So are the words of the man who presides over the Torah and its services and its service living here in Corfu. So that's the rabbi of Corfu. And he says, obviously, they're kosher. So here we have different opinions along the spectrum. The first rabbi says it's kosher. The next one says not kosher. The next one says not kosher, but the other one's Parga is kosher. This guy's saying Parga and Corfu are kosher. So we have all these different opinions. Chassam Sofer would say only the Italian ones. None of the Greek ones are kosher. This guy says all the Greek ones are kosher. So we have opinions all across the board. Text 15, Rabbi Shlomo Kluger. Next one. With regard to the debate surrounding the Corfu Esrogim, I've categorically disqualified all Esrogim from Parga and Corfu. He also says no good, for I've checked them for years and found signs of grafting. Additionally, I know for certain that every day new orchards spring up over there, and thus I categorically disqualify the whole lot of them. In other words, if you have new orchards that are just cropping up, right, a full-on orchard, well, how does that happen? How do you get a full orchard, you know, just coming up? Maybe it's probably because it's been grafted into something that already is existing. He says the whole lot is no good. The debate went on, and there were literally hundreds and hundreds of responses of rabbis writing back and forth, taking each side and each variance of the sides. And here's what happened next. In 1875, the farmers of Corfu, the local Greek farmers who would make a killing selling to the Jews, they decided to put to make it scarce. Supply and demand? To make the supply scarce and bump up the price. They got together and made a cartel and said, Esrogim now are $500 a piece. Because they knew that the Jewish community, those that bought, loved it and whatever. At this point, all the rabbis came out and said, don't buy the Corfu. Even the ones that felt that it was kosher felt that to give in to these practices would be devastating financially for the community, and the only way to break this attempted cartel is
boycott.
The boycott. The local Jewish community in Corfu that also was in on this business, because they would buy it from them and then distribute it, they agreed to the ban and basically to relinquish all the money that they would get as being part of that sale, and they took a loss, and they took a massive financial loss, but it was universally, unanimously decided that that couldn't happen. After that, the price broke, and once again, the debate settled into its various corners as it was. Some said it's good, some said it's not good, people bought, people didn't buy. It's the best, it's the worst, right? Opinions from all the sides, until something else happened. And this happened in 1891. In 1891, there was a girl, a young woman, who was found murdered near the Jewish ghetto of Corfu. And the locals said, you know who this was? This was a Christian girl. And you know why she was killed? Oh, shortly before Passover. Did I say that? I may not have said that. Shortly before Passover. Shortly before Passover, this woman was found, a young woman was found near the Jewish ghetto in Corfu, And the locals were saying, you know who did it? The Jews. Why did they do it? For the blood, for the matzah. The old middle, the blood libel, straight up the blood libel. And what happened is they incited, they put weapons in the church, and they went and incited the violence, and 139 Jews were killed in that massacre, in the bloodshed. They found out when they did an investigation that this girl, far from being a blood libel situation, she was a Jewish girl. She was a Jewish girl from a prominent family who was raped and murdered. And that turned into a blood, it's just the craziest thing. At that point, all the rabbis said, if the local community in Corfu would turn against the Jewish community like that, remember, they were the ones that were the farmers, they said, no, not buying it. You think if it has a blemish, it's no good. If it's a blood esrog, it's for sure not good. These esrogs had blood. The telegrams went immediately everywhere to Newark, New Jersey, where they would also buy the Karfu esrogim. No, even in the United States of America, the Jews stopped buying it. And that was the end of the Karfu. At the same time, there was another type of esrog that began becoming available, and that was the Israeli esrog. What happened was they took vines, branches from Italy, they took esrogim from Italy, and they planted them in Israel under the guidance of leading rabbis in Israel, as Israel is becoming more Jewish and populous. And those rabbis certified that those esrogim in Israel were kosher. And so you had many rabbis, including the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, text 16, Rabbi Yechiel Michal HaLevi Epstein, who said to use Israeli esrogim. Here we go, text 16. We are only allowed to use an esrog that is known to be traditionally free from any concern of grafting, such as the esrogim that come from Israel, where there are great rabbis and scholars who supervise the orchards to prevent any grafting. There is absolutely no permission to use the esrogim of Corfu. Every God-fearing Jew should only use the esrogim of Israel. If one has the opportunity to use produce of our holy land for a mitzvah, how can he not be ashamed to go ahead and specifically use a product from another land? Woe unto us for such shame and degradation. His point is, buy Israeli, right? Buy Israel. Produce. That was his thing. At the same time, if you follow the Chassam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, what did he say? Chassam Sofer said, it's better to rely on ancient tradition, which would point to which one? Which esrogim? The Italian. So what do I have right in front of me? I have an Israeli, and I have the Italian. I call him the Italian stallion. Let's take a look at this guy. The Italian is probably going to be greener and wider. And no pitum. Look at this guy. You see the difference?
You mean that's from Israel, the yellow one?
Israel? Italy.
Why's the Italy from green?
It's just less ripe.
Oh, okay.
Just less ripe. It will get yellow. It will last longer. But you also notice there's a difference. This is more waxy in finish. You see, this is like more shiny. This is more waxy. You can, after the class, you can come over and do side by side. It's not just about the color. They're both kosher. And so you have some opinions that say it's preferable to buy Israel because you're supporting Israel and the great rabbis there were supervising, and we know it's kosher, so it's kosher and it's Israel and it can't get any better. And some say, but for how many
centuries? This tree in Florida, is it kosher?
I'm sure it's kosher, right?
Came from a kosher approach.
That's it. That's it. No grafted. You grafted? There you go. I trust him. I take him on his word. Some say, though.
That has random bumps, the yellow.
Yeah.
This one has vertical columns if you turn.
Yeah. It's got, well, this is muscular. This is very muscular. This has been working out. This is like, no, I'm kidding. Yeah, right. It's very different. Yo, you can see it's different.
Yeah.
You can see it's different. So again, see how it goes in at the bottom, even though this goes out, but it goes, it's indented a little bit, whatever. Some will say Italy is Italy. God took Moses to Italy, to Calabria, to pick the esrog. That's the one where Ashkenazic Jews for centuries got their esrogim from. Let's stick to Italy. Some say Israel. You gotta go Israel. And what's the answer? Both are kosher. To now get back to your question. So for the last 3,000 years, we've been fighting over what's the kosher esrog. What are we driving ourselves crazy for? It's an Esrog. Move on. So here's how I want to frame it, and then we'll close out the class. Imagine a person's wife says to him, imagine if the wife tells the husband, honey, can you please go out? I'm in the mood for a milkshake. I like vanilla ice cream with chocolate syrup, crushed cookies and cookie dough with whipped cream and a cherry, and describing it in very...
Shaking,
not stirred, like a whole thing. And the husband's a loving husband. So he goes out and he goes to one place. Ah, you're not doing it right. Goes to another ice cream. Nah, you're not doing it right. And then he starts discussing it because he's looking for something specific. And everyone's giving feedback on what they think she meant. And now it's a whole discussion. Why is he doing it? Because he loves her and he wants to get it right. For the last 3,000 years, we love God, and God says, get a beautiful fruit, the fruit of a beautiful tree. We want to get it right. We want to get it right. And so rabbis have like very heated debate about what is beautiful and what is the right one. Why? Not because it's petty or it's silly or it's a waste of time. No, it's because we're trying to get it right. In truth, the story of the Carfu Esrog and the debate that engulfed European Jewry, Ashkenazic Jewry, yes, no, etc., kosher, not kosher, it's truly a love story on some level. It's a love story about our dedication to God. So let us always appreciate a mitzvah and strive to do it the best way we know how. All right.
I have a question.
Yes.
So what about on the first page? It says, our sages in the Midrash tell us that the four kinds represent the various types of personalities that comprise of the community of Israel, whose intrinsic unity we emphasize. So what are the four different items?
I'll speak about that in a second. I'm going to formally close it out, and then I'll answer that question. Thank you very much for coming tonight to our final session of High Holiday Boot Camp and our final session of Torah studies of this semester. Looking forward to seeing everybody in a week or two when we get back to Torah studies, Wednesday nights. We're back to Wednesday nights. All right. Thank you. Chag Sameach.